This is Robotech Master. Welcome to my commentary track for episode 70 of Robotech, Intermarlene. The episode was called Battlefield Requiem in Mos Vita, of which it was the 10th episode, and that continues the theme of putting a musical item in each title. The episode itself is one of the more important episodes of the new generation, as it represents a turning point in several different ways. It introduces the last main character, Ariel, otherwise known as Marlene, whose relationship with Scott ties back to his late fiancée and is an important plot point in the upcoming Shadow Chronicles movie. It adds three more fighter planes to the new generation's forces, and it causes a change in Scott's attitude. He can no longer realistically hope to rejoin his battalion. He and the others can rely only on themselves. Now, you'll notice the opening credits for the remastered version of Robotech are significantly different from the old version. The footage that you're seeing here is largely from the Mos Vita's opening titles. It's very stylized, as you can tell by the way those gun blasts turned into missiles or that giant glowing head you just saw. It was animated by a different animator than the main show, which explains the difference. As you can tell, they added a lot of sound effects for this. Essentially, if it moved, they put a sound effect on it. Don't ask me why Harmony Gold thinks that zooming out through somebody's eyes makes a whoosh sound. Now we see the narration and the Envid Simul Agent's placement. The narration was not present in the original show, of course. The incident was handled very much as a mysterious accident. Mos Vita left her origin and her purpose more of a mystery to puzzle viewers. Robotech filled it in, perhaps underestimating viewers' intelligence and causing problems reconciling it with what we see. It doesn't really make sense that the Regis should consider this particular small band of travelers interesting enough to put a spy into their midst, or even be aware of them as individuals rather than just more annoying gnats to brush off. You'll notice the narrator was being a little sarcastic there with his careful placement. Now, as later episodes show, there were hundreds or thousands of other survivor groups converging on Reflex Point from all directions. Why should Scott's band be any different, different enough to merit a spy? It doesn't fit with the footage that clearly shows the carrying container accidentally breaking while in flight, or with the Envid attacking the group later on after the spy's insertion, in one case shooting directly at her. Also, if the Regis is so closely connected to her children, why doesn't she notice that this one was dropped on her head at birth, so to speak? It's never explained in the original series where Aisha came from, that is, Marlene's original name, Aisha, or why she's humanoid when hatched from the egg rather than transmutated from a soldier, like Korg or Sera. It is worth noting that any Envid-created humanoid form was obviously lacking from the dinosaur-ridden Genesis pit that Scott, Rand, and Annie fell into in the previous episode. Perhaps Aisha and other human Envid would have hatched out from eggs later in the experiment, for the purpose of determining the suitability of various life forms, if Scott's group's arrival hadn't thrown a monkey wrench into things, and perhaps Aisha was being evacuated from the pit's control center when her transport case, damaged in the cave-in, shattered. Or maybe she was some sort of queen egg being transported from one hive to another for some other reason. We'll never know. Now let's get into the background of Point K. When Scott was speaking just now, he said a few interesting things about Point K. He said that the base was set down by Admiral Hunter at a time when Admiral Hunter wasn't sure who the enemy was. It makes it a little bit hard to date the foundation of Point K. In Mos Vita, it was the target point for Mars Base 7 Division, another part of Stick Bernard's group, so it had only been there just as long as Stick had been on the Earth. But in Robotech, we can choose to say that Admiral Hunter set down is probably shorthand for the forces dispatched by Admiral Hunter, but some fans believe that Hunter could have come back to Earth himself to establish Point K at the start of the Envid invasion personally, and then returned to Tyrol. It does seem to contradict existing Sentinels continuities, but Sentinels is no longer necessarily canonical in any form, if indeed it ever was. The only way to know for sure will be if Shadow Chronicles or some future sequel specifically states whether Hunter was ever back to Earth or not. Now, in my opinion, Point K was probably created by a new REF wave that came soon after the Envid arrival, but before the REF knew about the Envid. The fact that Scott was able to cite specific figures for how many troops were there does suggest that it was in contact with his Mars Division since they hit Earth space. It has to have been destroyed relatively recently, recently enough that Rand and Rook can believe Marlene could be a survivor of the attack. As to why the Invid left them alone for so long, well, perhaps taking out the Southern Cross depleted their troop strength. Or perhaps they didn't consider it a significant threat until this new human fleet arrived to reinforce it. It does have betas that Lunk has never heard of. Presumably they were survivors from Scott's Mars division that made it down to link up. The question of dating the foundation of Point K is sort of a symptom of a larger issue. You see, as a whole, the Robotech series is fraught with contradictions and errors that were introduced by the unusually rapid pace of its rewriting and dubbing. There are often few or no visual date cues, and dialogue often contradicts the date cues that do exist. In the end, it's not really remarkable that there are contradictions in Robotech. It's remarkable that it hangs together as well as it does. In the end, there really was no true official Robotech timeline for the longest time. There were just those from the role-playing game, novels, comics, and so forth, that invariably contradicted each other and the show. Back in the early to mid-90s, some Robotech fans looked at the little details and visual cues and so forth in the show with the idea of making a more consistent timeline. Only in the end, there turned out to be two different camps who couldn't quite agree on which details were important and which ones should be discarded. The two camps styled themselves Early Return and Late Return. Early Return holds that the REF had left Earth entirely by sometime in the late 2010s, and they returned to Earth in the mid-2030s, shortly after the Robotech Masters had been defeated, with the Invid being on Earth no more than 5 years or so. Late Return has the REF departing in waves all through the 2010s and early 2020s. It places the Robotech Masters' defeat at 2030, the Invid's occupation starting at 2031, and Scott's band returning in 2042. I personally find that Late Return makes more sense because the Earth really needs to have been occupied for a long period of time for humanity to get as demoralized as it's shown as being in the New Generation episodes. In Mospita, it had been occupied for 30 years. 10 seems like a reasonable compromise. Harmony Gold apparently felt the same way. When they were getting ready to make Shadow Chronicles, for the construction of their writer's Bible, they looked at both Early Return and Late Return scenarios to figure out which one made the most sense. Although they found there were good points on both sides, they ended up settling with a timeline that was closer to, though not completely identical with, that proposed by Late Return proponents. I've put links to essays written by Early Return proponent Stan Bundy and Late Return proponent Peter Walker on the page from which you downloaded this commentary. Read them both. See which one you think makes the most sense. In an interview with Chief Robotech writer Greg Snegoff on Darkwater's old Shadow Chronicles news site, Snegoff stated that they tended to have to throw out dialogue from the original episodes and write from scratch when they were writing the Robotech adaptation. However, he may have been referring more to Macross and Southern Cross, because in most episodes of New Generation, the dialogue is remarkably faithful to the Mospita original, right down to little details, even when there's no reason for those details to be in the show. An example is Rand's remark here about déjà vu. That remark was also in the original Genesis Climber Mospita, only there it had a reason to be, because in Mospita, Ray's generation are latent psychics, having been born into Invid telepathic fields. This sort of foreshadows his telepathic contact with Marlene or Aisha later on in the Sandstorm episode, as well as explaining why he was able to figure out the purpose of the Genesis Pit in the last episode so quickly. He was subconsciously picking up on Invid communication signals. Since Rand isn't supposed to be psychic, the déjà vu remark really makes no sense here, but it was held over from Genesis Climber Mospita anyway. And now we get to meet Marlene for the first time. Now in Mospita, the mysterious girl is renamed Aisha, which amusingly enough is also a popular name for African-American girls these days. The reason for that is that historically, Aisha was the name of the final wife of the Prophet Muhammad. Captain JLS suggests that Mospita writers might have been fully aware of this when they named the character, given that one possible subtext for Mospita is the Crusades, Christianity versus Islam to take back the Holy Land. In Mospita, Stick Bernard thinks that this girl has a queenly demeanor, and so Yellow Belmont suggests the name Aisha because he seems to remember it means queen in some language. Aisha is probably also where we get her Enfid name, Ariel, which also starts with an A and has five letters. Ariel is actually a masculine Hebrew name that means Lion of God, and in fact it's still in use in that sense today in Israel, for example, Ariel Sharon. Nonetheless, the most famous Ariel in Western culture is probably the androgynous but usually considered female air spirit who is the servant of Prospero in Shakespeare's The Tempest. Shakespeare's making a play on words, you see, on the spirit being of the air, that is, Ariel. Perhaps the Robotech writers saw a parallel between Marlene and Shakespeare's Ariel. I'm not sure, but I do know that in Shakespeare's play toward the end, she appears as a magical air creature, a harpy, to stop some murderers from their wrongdoing. In Robotech, Scott suggests naming the girl Marlene. As I'll explain later, this was actually a mistake on the part of the Robotech writers. The Mospita writers never intended for Aisha to bear quite that level of resemblance to Scott's late fiancée. However, nobody realized this at the time. Now, the Jack McKinney novelizations claim that Ariel was created as a clone from the original Marlene Rush's genetic material found in a crashed shuttle. How's that for a coincidence for you? And thus has the original Marlene's memories buried, much as Zor Prime had the original Zors in Southern Cross. I seem to recall she regains these memories in End of the Circle. A story in the Mospita DVD set's liner notes implies that during the crash of the shuttle, the original Marlene was being examined by the Regis to try to understand love, and so was protected by a force field and landed safely. However, she had amnesia until she made her way to Reflex Point and remembered her name and the fact that she had a fiancé. This doesn't seem to be canonical, given that Stick and Aisha are still together in Love, Live Alive, the Mospita sequel OAV. Nonetheless, if it were, Stick and Aisha would be in for a nasty surprise. About half of these blueprint shots were added back in for the remastered edition. You'll notice at one point they say TLED, T-L-E-A-D. This is because the original name of the Beta was the TRED, just as the Alpha was the Legius. In Japanese, L and R are often interchangeable. Now there's an interesting bit of dialogue coming up here. Lunk refers to the band as having five fighters and three cyclones, and then Scott says five lousy fighters. The funny thing is, if you count them up in your head, you realize they've got four fighters and four cyclones. One each for Scott, Rand, Rook, and Lancer. Ironically, this is not entirely a dubbing error. It's actually an error that's carried over from the original source material. Jim Worston, in Mospita, claims to have found two Legius and two Treads for a total of five fighters. The thing is, we never see two Treads or Betas parked together, flying together, or any indication from the animation that there ever actually were two at all. It might have been a glitch in communication between the writers and the animators, or if we take the count at face value, we can only assume that Rand's crash totaled one of the Betas, though it looked relatively undamaged, and the one we see in the last scene has the same number on it as the one he crashed. Nonetheless, regardless of whether it was four or five fighters, Scott's band suddenly has a lot more fighters than they used to have. It's interesting to note that the original vision of Genesis Climber Mospita was that it would be transforming motorcycles all the way to Reflex Point, with fighter planes never to be seen again after the first episode. It would have made for a more bleak, hard-scrabble show, kind of like a futuristic Seven Samurai, as the group of freedom fighters has to try to avoid confrontation with larger groups of Enbit, rather than be able to blast through them with their fighters. You can see hints of this kind of thing in Hired Gun, the Dusty Airs episode, which was even bleaker in the original Mospita version than in Robotech. Who knows, it might even have been a better story that way, with more chance for drama when you're not able to do as much against the Enbit. But pressure came from their producer and their sponsor and so forth to make the show more like Macross, include more fighter planes. Thus, one fighter is reintroduced in the third episode, and here come three more in the tenth. If it seems a bit unrealistic that a country bumpkin and a motorcycle gangster can learn to pilot fighter planes well enough to be a very effective fighting force within just a couple of episodes, well, that's why. Ironically, in making it more like Macross, they may have made the story weaker and perhaps contributed to the show's mediocre success in Japan. But since Carl Masick was specifically looking for Macross-like shows to combine in Robotech, that may also be why the show is still known to this day at all. Here we see Scott's overall loss of direction. All through the series thus far, he's clearly been making for Point K, clearly expecting to rejoin Remnants of Mars Division, not having to go all the way to Reflex Point on his own. Presumably, he's planned this all along, thinking to make sure the civilians were safe, i.e. leave them behind, as he would later do in Dark Finale, and hook up with a full-scale military force to go smack down the Invid. Despite what happened to him in the first episode of New Generation, he never seriously considered that an entire large military force of 6,000 people could be completely wiped out. He never seriously considered having to wage a guerrilla war. Now his hopes are shattered and he's lost everything. He doesn't have any reason to go on. But then, Ariel's arrival changes this and gives him something new to fight for. And here it looks like Marlene is reacting to Scott. But as we see a moment later, she's actually reacting to the Invid. Now, though she doesn't get to do much in this episode apart from scream, Marlene is voiced by Melanie McQueen, credited as Aileen Leslie in the original since it was a non-guild role. She also played Lisa Hayes. However, in Shadow Chronicles, Ariel is played by Kari Wahlgren, and Melanie McQueen only gets a cameo appearance as Scott's late fiancée, Marlene Rush. Tommy Yoon has explained that in consultations with Moss Beater writer Kenji Terada, it came out that Ariel's resemblance to and identification with Marlene Rush was a mistake, probably a consequence of the unusually rapid-paced rewriting and dubbing process for the original Robotech. In Moss Beater, Aisha was never meant to bear such a close resemblance to the late Marlene. She was meant to remind Stick of her in a general shell-shocked Vietnam veteran sort of way, but not to look like her and speak with the same voice. It was too much of a coincidence, and trying to explain it the way Jack McKinney did could be too confusing for new viewers. So for Shadow Chronicles, they decided to return to the original intentions of the Moss Beater writers and downplay the resemblance. Thus, Ariel has a different voice and insists that Scott no longer call her Marlene. Apparently nobody ever explained this rationale to Melanie McQueen, as she was quite indignant about the casting change in an interview on Darkwater's defunct Shadow Chronicles news site. She didn't know why it had been made. Hopefully, Melanie will get a larger role in future Robotech productions. Who knows, maybe we could see Lisa Hayes again. Okay, there goes Scott, mad as hell, not gonna take it anymore, and firing off missiles left, right, and center in a dazzling display of stock footage. More than once during the series, Scott has fired all 80 of his Alpha's rockets simultaneously in a spectacular maneuver that has come to be called Scott Bernarding. It is a subject of considerable fan speculation as to where exactly he gets all his reloads. Now watch Rand and his motorcycle as they flip into the air. Rand and the motorcycle go up, and the motorcycle mysteriously evaporates before Rand hits the ground. What's more, it's never seen again in any of the subsequent shots showing Rand in the pit. I wonder where it went. Now, if you're watching this on a 5.1 speaker system right now, you're probably hearing battle sounds and gunfire and explosions go on all around you. That's one of the things I really like about these new remastered editions, the great 5.1 sound mix. Some people are not as fond of it, feeling that it's overly loud and lacks subtlety. But if you're nostalgic for the old version, Harmony Gold's sound engineers say that if you have the control over your speakers, you can turn down your front and rear surrounds and turn up your front middle speaker, because the original Robotech soundtrack is essentially right there on that front middle speaker. There may be some bleed-through from the separate channels, but for the most part, that's the original dialogue and sound mix right there in mono. Or you can sort of go halfway by turning the middle up and the front and rear down, but not all the way down, so that you hear the original soundtrack plus the new stuff to emphasize it. Now, how exactly does Scott know that it's Rand in that beta? Maybe Rand accidentally turned on the radio when he was trying to turn on the jets. That beta's controls sure have to be pretty simple, don't they, for a country bumpkin who's never flown a plane before in his life, as far as we know, to nonetheless be able to launch it and fly it and even dodge enemy fire fairly well. It's only in the landing that he has a little trouble, and even then he still manages to take out an Invid trooper. Built tough, too. Now we get to see all three Alphas and the Beta together for the first time. Notice that the cyclone compartments behind the cockpit on the Alphas are open. Here's another one of those lines that was fundamentally the same in Moss Beater as it is in Robotech. Ray answers Stick in the original, "I think I can just about manage horizontal flight." which is just about the same as long as I don't have to turn left or right. Rook's response is actually, sure, I'm good with machines, implying that she doesn't quite know how to fly the Alpha yet, but she believes she can pick it up as she goes. Something interesting about the red Alpha that Rook flies. In Mospita, this Alpha hails from Jupiter base, just as the green and blue Alphas hail from Mars base. The toy even has a Jupiter base logo on it, though this is never seen in the show. Ironically, Sue Graham's Jupiter division, seen in the last few episodes, doesn't have any of these red Alphas in it, being composed mostly of shadow fighters. In Mospita, it came from a base on the dark side of the moon, tying in with the light and shadow duality that was a major theme in Mospita, and that can still be seen in Robotech in remnants such as the Regis's Shadow of the Robotech Masters or Children of the Shadow dialogue in the last few episodes. This Regis voiceover, along with all the other Regis voiceovers in this episode, was not there in the Mospita version. In Mospita, we sometimes, rarely, hear the Regis, or rather, Reefless, addressing her troops, usually just something like, delete the soldiers from Mars base, delete them, delete them. But more often, we just see the Invid as these mysterious aliens who follow their own dictates, and sometimes even talk to each other. As we've seen, Enter Marlene presents a turning point for the New Generation series. Before this episode, while not exactly carefree, none of the group seemed to worry too much about the big picture, how they would get to Reflex Point, what they would do when they got there. Unconsciously, Scott was thinking he could still hook up with the rest of the military. But now they're going to have to become more of an actual guerrilla force, a band of brothers, so to speak. The mood gets tenser, especially in episodes like Sandstorm or Separate Ways, where they're all at each other's throats. Scott knows he may be all that's left of Mars Division, and he has to fight the Invid even if he's all by himself. At least now he has Marlene to keep him going, even if there are times she doesn't seem quite all right. And that's all I have time for. I hope you've enjoyed this commentary track. If you have any questions, just give me an email at robotech@eyrie.org.